Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us in the studio is Blaine Harden, a contributor to The Economist and a reporter for PBS's Frontline. He has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, East Europe, and Africa, and is the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. And his latest book just out is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Blaine Harden.
Good to be here.
And this is a remarkable story, and of course, it is so hard to understand what happened to this person growing up in the camp, being born into slavery with his parents, who were, mother, of course, was later hanged along with his brother, who was executed. The brutality is incomprehensible. And when you contrast that to the adulation of the sort of boy king in this peculiar, paradoxical communist dynasty, it is just, as I say, it is incomprehensible.
Yeah, it's very hard to get your head around the idea that there's this young leader and his attractive, modern-looking wife running, controlling in an absolute way, a place that continues to enslave its political enemies in camps that it denies exist.
So is the compact similar to the one, for example, in Syria, where the Assads are the family that believe that they have a divine right to run the country, and if as long as you go along with them and don't object, you can live your life in safety. But the minute you raise any minor objection, you're dead. I mean, it seems to me that there's nothing quite as systemic as the kind of repression in North Korea, because there is this godlike adulation. So I suppose if you don't go along with the program, you are by definition a heretic.
That's true. But there are sort of degrees of repression. And compare North Korea to any other state, Syria included, I think is to give North Korea too much of a break. In Syria, it's possible, before the uprising, to make a living, to eat, no matter who you were. In North Korea, a third of the population is always hungry. There have been World Food Program and UNICEF nutrition surveys over the past 15, 20 years, since the big famine in the mid-90s. And they show that a third of the population is not only hungry, but stunted, and a significant percentage of children are impaired intellectually because of childhood malnutrition. And this is an ongoing crisis. And the people who are hungry are those who are out of favor politically. The farther you get away from Pyongyang, the capital, towards the periphery, the hungrier people are, and they've been sent there because they're not perceived to be loyal. So that is one great human rights atrocity for its own people, not to mention the camps. In the camps, that's where they send people who are perceived to be outspoken enemies or related to outspoken enemies, and the camps perform a sort of classic totalitarian function, is they isolate and eliminate perceived enemies, and they scare the hell out of everybody else in the country and keep the country quiet.
So is starvation then a policy? Because obviously if you keep a third of your people weak, starved, preoccupied with trying to find food, they're not exactly fomenting revolution, are they?
To a certain extent, one would have to conclude that it's a policy. For many years, the technocrats in the North Korean government have been talking to technocrats in South Korea about industrialization along a Chinese model. Kim Jong-il resisted it. Attempts to widen economic activity along that Chinese capitalist idea just didn't go through. He was very suspicious of it. He saw that wealth that he didn't control to be dissidents and didn't permit it. And because of that, wealth did not grow, and there's just not enough money in the country to import the food they need, and they can't grow their food because it's a country mostly of rocks and mountains. So one could only conclude that hunger is a policy choice made by those who are not hungry and who are in control and want to stay in control.
Again, I'm speaking with Blaine Harden, a contributor to The Economist and reporter for PBS's Frontline. He formerly served as the Washington Post's bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa, and is the author of the new book, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. Let's turn to Shin, this extraordinary survivor, because the conditions into which he was born, in which he grew up, and from which he finally escaped are pretty much incomprehensible to, I think, anybody in the West. And I take it you must, I mean, it's an inspiring story of just the human capacity to suffer and survive. And what about the last stage? Give us a sense of where he's at now.
Well, where he's at now is in a much, much better place than when I met him in December 2008 and started working on the reporting for the book. Now he is doing webcasting, living in Seoul. He has really enjoyed the success of the book in as much that he feels validated. He knows that there's an audience in the United States and around the world. The book's been published in 19 languages now, that have paid attention to his story and understood what he went through and what hundreds of thousands of people are still going through in these five big camps that remain. So he's very much encouraged by that. At the same time, he feels guilt that they're still in the camps, and he's out enjoying a life where he does have food to eat and clothes to wear.
So how does he deal with the denial in South Korea? Because this is one of the extraordinary things about trying to get a handle on North Korea, is that a lot of South Koreans, because they grew up under a kind of military dictatorship, are very suspicious of their own government. It was only until the North Koreans recently shelled that island, and it was seen live on television, a lot of South Koreans finally realized that maybe there's something really to the propaganda they've been hearing.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that most South Koreans are aware of what North Korea is and how it operates. And that's been the case for many decades. They're pretty cognizant of the brutality and the kind of place it is. But they're also incredibly bored by it. It's a place that goes nowhere. It's the 14th century. It's the past, and they're really looking towards the future in a way that almost no country in the world is. To understand South Korea, you have to know how obsessed it is with success. Right now, according to the OECD statistics, people work more, sleep less, spend more time on the internet, spend more money on cram courses to learn English, and kill themselves at the highest rate of any developed country in the world. They are absolutely obsessed with progress, narrowly defined as the right job, the right university, the right income, the right house, and the right car. And what that has to do with Kim Jong-un and the creaky old dictatorship is virtually nothing. And so they tend not to pay real close attention. When they're shelling, when the North Koreans sink a ship, they talk about it, but they just get on with progress.
But, well, I just recall at the time of the sinking of the warship, there was still a substantial amount of suspicion, and people were giving the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I'm just talking to the South Korean left or something.
Well, the South Korean left is active. It does exist, but it's not where the sort of the majority opinion of the country. Most people realize that North Korea was involved in sinking that ship, but they also realize that engaging North Korea in a conflict or an escalation of tension that could lead to conflict is a place they don't want to go. They have so much more to lose than the North Koreans
do. So what about then this idea that the familial ties are so deep, that the head of Hyundai keeps trying to reach out all the time, and he created the tourism industry, which basically became a big subsidy for the North until they shot some poor tourist, and now they're even talking about renewing that, some sacred mountains or something. What about that kind of familial tie? Is that still very real? Although they must be getting elderly, most of the people.
Yeah. With each passing year, those ties become more attenuated. The people who know their relatives across the border are in their 60s and 70s, or they're dead. And the interest that young people have in paying for unification, a bill that would run into the trillions, according to the estimates that South Korean government has done, they're not very interested in doing it. They're interested in the idea of doing it, but they want to postpone it for a good long time.
Well, tell me then, Blaine Hardin, how does Shin feel then? You just told us that this incredibly successful South Korea, at the end of the day, it's more people commit suicide than anywhere else. So you have this bizarre comparison between a successful country driven by tremendous urges to learn English and become successful, et cetera, and it's so manic to the point that a lot of people commit suicide. Contrast that to a country where people are starving and being brutalized by an insane regime. It's hard to believe that there's only a little border between the two of them, isn't it?
Well, it's quite a militarized border, as a matter of fact. But there are now between 24,000 North Koreans living in South Korea. These are defectors who've come in the past 12, 14 years. Before then, there were none. And they come to South Korea and they have a devil of a time finding purchase, finding a way to make a living and just understand what their role is in life. They really struggle. And Shin, because he's special, because he's unique, has gotten attention, and his story has made him a kind of public figure. And now, because he's doing webcasting, he often sits in a studio like we're sitting with another defector, and they talk about what life was like in North Korea and how hard it is for both of them to find a way forward living in South Korea. So he's found sort of a meaning in what he's doing. He struggled mightily in South Korea when he first got there. And now, because there are so many North Koreans there, he has found a reason to live and a profession going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Blaine Hardin, the author of Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. So conversely, my understanding is that the Achilles heel of the North Korean regime is the extent to which the bubble is slowly being burst that people live in by bootleg copies of South Korean soap operas that are available in the black market in North Korea. And in fact, the authorities, in trying to stamp it out, apparently cut off the power in various areas so that the VCRs get jammed in the machines and then they arrest these poor people. So we've got a sense of the cultural disconnect from those that flee the North and try to deal with the materialism in the South. What about the materialism of the South being the Achilles heel of the regime in the North?
Well, I think the story of what's going on in the North in terms of the information that they're beginning to absorb or have been absorbing for the past decade is probably the most important change, along with the scruffy street markets where most people buy their food and their goods. What's happened with North Korea is that the totalitarian system has remained in control, but two fundamental things have changed. Information control has really, really eroded. Part of it is all small Chinese electronics that have come across this semi-permeable border between the North and China. And so now it's possible for a very large number of people to listen to radio. The United States government and South Korea have funded an enormous radio operation. So if you have the vaguest of radios, you can receive, you're bombarded with counter-regime propaganda. The U.S. government recently released a report showing that a very significant percentage of the population listens regularly to this radio. So they know what's going on, and they see the DVDs and the CDs that come across the border with the soaps from South Korea. I talked to a young guy who said he learned about the United States from watching knockoffs of Charlie's Angels and from James Bond movies. And that's been going on for a decade, and that's changed the... It's changed the intellectual reality of life in North Korea. People know that they're living in a hellhole, and they know that every place else is better off. And the North Korean government, in fact, knows that they know, and they try to spin it in this way, that the reason you're suffering, the reason you're hungry, the reason there's no electricity, is because of those evil Americans and their
puppet regime.
And the puppet regime in South Korea. Mm-hmm. So they've tried to do that, but still people are unhappy and they're beginning to understand how deep a hole they're in. And that's new. And the second thing is the regime's ability to deliver food. Before the Soviet Union collapsed, North Korea could sell shoddy goods to the Soviets and get money and cheap fuel and fuel fertilizer. That game ended. There was a massive famine. And now the way the economy works is people trade stuff that they've smuggled across the border from China.
So the country now is beset by floods. Recently, there was stories in the South Korean press that the North, the new leader who hasn't been given a mantle of either being the great leader or the dear leader yet, as far as I know, has he?
They call him the young general.
The young general.
That's the term that came out, and I think it still sort of sticks. But supreme leader now and marshal.
Well, apparently the North Koreans scoffed at the idea that there'd be any reforms. He's supposed to be the young general who hasn't served a day in the military. He's supposed to be heading to China. So give us a sense of what China gets out of this. I can understand what the Chinese don't want the regime to totally collapse and to have essentially the U.S. Army back on the Yellow River. I can understand that. But what is the glue that holds China and North Korea together?
Well, I think that buffer is part of it. Part of it is they do not want a chaotic collapse of the state with sort of an uncontrolled flow of people of North Koreans across that border. The border between China and North Korea is not exactly a border between Chinese people and Korean people. There are a lot of ethnic Korean people on the Chinese side of that border, millions. And controlling that border and keeping a puppet regime, or at least a regime that they feel that is a kind of puppet, is much more comforting to them in terms of their own population. And then there's also there are valuable minerals in North Korea, $1 trillion worth of iron ore, molybdenum, other things that China needs for its aerospace industry, and that it is exploiting now. And then there is the question of having a U.S.-allied Korean peninsula on its border. So all those things, I think. But one other thing is that in my reporting with South Korean people who are South Korean technocrats and bureaucrats who are dealing with China and North Korea on a business level, they think that China very much wants to slowly open up North Korea to its style of communism and to lower the temperatures in terms of the missiles and nuclear threat, so that goes away. And so it's sort of business as usual, and as dealing with Southeast Asia, with Burma or with Vietnam. That's the kind of model I think that a lot of bureaucrats, technocrats in Beijing would like to see.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West, Blaine Harden.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Blaine Harden, a contributor to The Economist and a reporter for PBS's Frontline. He has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa, and is the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. And his latest book just out is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manners. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night.
disappeared by